Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 18th of March. I love talking about U.S. presidents, and there is some reconsideration of how effective Ulysses S. Grant was as president of the United States. For many, many years, historians have thought that he ranked in the bottom tier, and some years ago, thought he was near the bottom of U.S. presidents in terms of how effective he was. But there's some reexamination going on, and some are saying that we need to look more carefully at Reconstruction policies and what President Grant thought about those and how he worked in terms of trying to change the way the nation looked at slavery and the way that it looked at what to do about incorporating new ideas into a new America that was shaping after the Civil War. One historian wrote recently that though much of the public and even some historians haven't yet heard the news, the vindication of Ulysses S. Grant is well underway. This is a professor at Princeton who says, "I expect that before too long, Grant will be returned to the standing he deserves, not only as the military savior of the Union, but as one of the greatest presidents of his era, and possibly one of the greatest in all American history." Our guest this hour has a favorable view of Ulysses S. Grant. He concludes that Grant dealt with many Reconstruction era issues in a firm and decisive manner and played a major role in establishing what would become the motivating principle behind a new world order during the next century. Professor Frank Scaturo is with us, visiting professor at Hofstra University School of Law, and we'll be talking about Ulysses S. Grant. Also, there's a movement to plug into something going on in the news to remove his picture from the $50 bill and replace it with Ronald Reagan. So you can talk about what you think about Ulysses S. Grant, and here's how you do with that. You call us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Scaturo, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's very nice to have you on the air. So did you always think pretty highly of Ulysses S. Grant, or did scholarship lead you to believe that he was better than you thought he was?
I have to tell you, I had become interested in the presidents in early grammar school, believe it or not, when I was 7 years old. And I guess I was a bit precocious when it came to history, and particularly presidential history. I singled out Grant around the ages of 12, 13, as I devoured everything that I could on the presidents, because the more that I read about Grant and his presidency, the less I could understand the traditional verdict of historians, which was actually very negative. I mean, as with, I think, the vast majority of the audience, pretty much everything I read about Grant's presidency was negative, very negative,
yes,
condemnatory. And the thing that struck me in what I read is not that I read positive appraisals of his presidency, although there were a couple buried in the mass of condemnations. But if you looked at the landmark works on his presidency, which are few, what you'd find were these, I thought, shallow Gilded Age character sketches that would talk sometimes and caricature the form of people who supposedly dominated the era, the robber baron types, and others who certainly were engaged in trying to influence the power brokers. But I found little discussion of the presidency itself and what Grant and what the people, you know, who are in his administration were actually doing. But every now and then in these narratives, you would find actual discussion of policy. And every time a policy came out, whether it was advocacy of civil rights or an achievement in foreign policy, and there were several occasions in which the country flirted with war and Grant kept the country out of war, you know, it just struck me that there were substantive policy issues that were discussed in these largely condemnatory narratives, and I came away from this more befuddled than when I started to explore his presidency, that historians clearly were getting something wrong, and that literary prescience were permitted to override the substantive historical record. I mean, I came out of what I had read thinking that the literature that we had on President Grant, on his presidency specifically, was collectively maybe the most analytically impoverished body of literature on any president.
Isn't that interesting?
It was really bad.
Let's center in on issues of race here. You talk about his being an advocate of civil rights. I'm interested in how he took on the Ku Klux Klan.
Mm-hmm.
This was a very difficult time to be president. How did he address those issues?
Yeah, so he came to office at a time when the country was on the verge of completing the second great revolution in our history. Of course, the first was the founding. The second came during the Civil War and Reconstruction. The nation had just ratified the 14th Amendment, which established that everyone was entitled to the equal protection of the laws. But it was on Grant's watch that the president faced the challenge of enforcing those rights and even extending those rights to the right to vote. Grant engaged in his first year in the White House. Although presidents don't directly approve constitutional amendments, he engaged in the arm twisting that was necessary to secure ratification of the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which says that no citizen can be denied the right to vote based upon race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Throughout his presidency, he faced the challenge of enforcing both the 14th and the 15th Amendment, and it wasn't an easy thing to do in the face of Southern recalcitrance. Those who had fought for or who had advocated the Confederate cause during the Civil War were not exactly penitent about what they had done. They were conquered, and they were not going to accept the equality of former slaves without a fight. During the Reconstruction era, an estimated 3,000 African Americans and their white allies were killed in acts of intimidation by terror groups such as the Ku Klux Klan, groups that were encouraged by the resistance of Grant's predecessor and Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, who did everything that he could to resist civil rights measures during Reconstruction. So Grant assumed office at a time when the country faced perhaps the most dysfunctional presidency in our history. He pushed through several measures, really landmark measures on civil rights, that included five what are known as enforcement acts between 1870 and 1872. The most prominent, the most sweeping of those was dubbed the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871. Pursuant to that act, Grant actually took the step of suspending habeas corpus in nine counties in South Carolina in the face of massive racial terrorism that was taking place. And following that was a firm prosecution of the Ku Klux Klan that led to the extinction of that group by 1872. The Klan that exists today was really founded around 1915. But that was one of the major parts of Grant's legacy. He was also the president who approved the establishment of the Justice Department in 1870. That was the single greatest expansion of our government's legal authority to enforce the law that we've seen in our country's history. And what happened after the crushing of the Klan in 72, it certainly did not end resistance to civil rights. You still had other groups such as the White Leaguers, Red Shirts, and some of the South Carolina Rifle Clubs that pushed to combine some Klan tactics with social ostracism and economic coercion to try to curtail the rights of African Americans. And there came a point during the mid-1870s when the country as a whole, when people in the North as well as in the South, obviously you're talking about predominantly white citizens, came to oppose Reconstruction. They grew tired of it. They grew opposed to it, and the program became very unpopular. In the midst of this opposition, the Republicans, who are the ones supporting the Reconstruction agenda, were thrown out of the House of Representatives. Democrats won sweeping victories at the polls in 1874, and many of the remaining Republicans in Congress felt that this was, in the words of Vice President Henry Wilson, a millstone around the neck of the Republican Party that would sink it. And this is an amazing thing coming from Wilson, because he, as a senator from Massachusetts in his prior career, had a superb legislative record as an abolitionist, even at a time when it wasn't popular. Well, Grant himself remained dedicated to civil rights to the end of his presidency, even as it was unpopular. In fact, in 1875, he signed into law a Civil Rights Act that 90 years before, the Civil Rights Act of 64, actually banned discrimination in various modes of transportation and public accommodations. It's amazing to think so early in our history you had this law that said there's no racial discrimination permitted in inns, theaters, railroads, streetcars, and places like that. By the end of Grant's presidency, you still had federal troops that were stationed in the South in order to sustain the remaining Republican regimes two of the three states where you had federal troops were black majority states, and that automatically made them more subject to the prospect of a takeover by those who were livid at the prospect of former slaves having political power. And the real collapse of Reconstruction, the end of Reconstruction, came with Grant's retirement from the White House and the arrival of Rutherford B. Hayes, who did what many thought political demands really required at the time. He pulled the last remaining troops from the South about a month and a half into his presidency. And what followed from there was a period that was euphemistically called home rule, where the South would be able to govern itself. Republican leadership, including Hayes, initially, I think, deceived themselves that this would not mean the end of equality, it would not mean the end of the gains that were made during the Civil War, but of course, in the history that followed, you had a slow undoing, more abrupt undoing in parts of the South, but over the next two decades, 25 years, you saw a whole new era seep into the South of segregation and disfranchisement, and you saw the Jim Crow laws that we've come to be familiar with. In 1883, the Supreme Court, which was pushing its own retreat from Reconstruction, that kind of changed its own views to match those of a country that had tired of civil rights, they actually declared the Civil Rights Act of 1875 unconstitutional. They threw it out, which is one reason we don't hear about it much anymore. It was a very strange decision when you consider that those who voted in Congress for the Civil Rights of 1875, they were doing this on the authority of the 14th Amendment, and so many of those who were voting for this legislation had themselves been framers of the 14th Amendment, who originally voted for it in Congress. And the Supreme Court was basically telling them that they didn't understand their own amendment.
Oh, my. Things could have been different. If things had been different, things could have been different now. It wouldn't have been as long a struggle. We need to pause for a moment. Frank Scaturo is our guest. We're talking about, I just love working at public radio when you can say we're going to talk about Ulysses S. Grant, and four phone lines just about immediately light up with people who know their presidents and want to join the discussion. It's good. To your phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, we're on the subject of presidents. I wanted to tell you that I'm going to be narrating Copland's Lincoln's Portrait with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, the Festival Symphony. It is with Monty Perkins as their music director. It's at the Pabst Theater, and they're doing Samuel Barber as well. So it's a grand piece, and I'm so honored to be a part of this. I hope I don't cry every time I hear his words. I start crying. At any rate, it's March 28 at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a good time for a chance for those of you in the Milwaukee area to come and hear some wonderful, stirring music. And I've had a chance to meet you as well. So that's the Milwaukee Festival Symphony, and it's a week from this Sunday, March 28th, at the Pabst Theater. I'll put something more on my Facebook page if you want to get more information, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our guest this hour is Frank Scaturo, visiting professor at Hofstra University School of Law. He is a presidential scholar and a grant scholar, and we go to Jerry from Cedarburg, our first caller. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I recently read a biography of Ulysses S. Grant, and in it, the author was quite critical of him in his abandonment of black people in the South in the Reconstruction period. And the author had commented that Grant made a conscious decision not to engage in pushing for those rights because he didn't want to have the country descend into another civil war, so to speak. And I'm just wondering what comments you could have on that. And one other thing was, he mentioned an incident, which is quite interesting to me. I'm a history teacher, and that was that while Grant's son was at West Point, he had engaged in some harassment of one of the first black cadets to go through West Point. And so I'd like to have a reaction on that, too. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, just the second question first on Grant's son at West Point. Charge was made more by innuendo in William McFeely's biography of Grant that won the Pulitzer Prize, actually, nearly 30 years ago. But it was, I think, thoroughly refuted in an article by Brooks Simpson that followed soon afterwards. The evidence that there was an African-American cadet that was subject to harassment, but there is no evidence that that Grant's son had anything to do with it or that he was particularly supportive of it. Now, on the broader point of whether Grant, in fact, engaged in an abandonment of Reconstruction, the one thing I could think of maybe his failure to intervene in Mississippi during the elections of 1875. At a time when Reconstruction policy had become very unpopular, Grant was under severe pressure to limit his use of federal troops, and he wanted to make sure that, of course, the federal troops were provided to protect voting rights where they were needed. But in the face of that pressure, when he's told, well, we're going to be losing so much of what we have nationwide, He wanted to ensure that the conditions absolutely required him to make a special deployment of troops to the polls in Mississippi for that 1875 election. What occurred between him and the governor, Adelbert Ames, was a series of correspondence back and forth where Ames did request the troops. Grant hesitated. He said, let's make sure they're necessary. His Attorney General, Edwards Pierpont, was a bit more hesitant to use troops than Grant was. Well, long story short, by the time you reached the election, Ames had actually changed his stance and said, you know, I think we're able to do what we can with the troops that are already in place, because there was a state militia that they had to protect the polls. And Grant incorrectly thought that there wouldn't be a special deployment necessary for the elections that year. Well, unfortunately, intimidation did take place. Democrats won they won the state legislature back and proceeded to impeach the governor, Adelbert Ames, and Grant pretty sternly condemned the new government in Mississippi, but it was too late. And that was a failure on his record, although it was one that occurred in the face of seemingly insuperable opposition to Reconstruction. But a broader point I would make, something I've found very interesting in the reputation of Grant and in the reputation of Lincoln after the Civil War, and this is one of the things that struck me that motivated me to write a reassessment of his presidency. One of the great what-if questions in American history is what would have happened had Lincoln not been assassinated, had he filled out his term. And for many years, we didn't talk so much about this trend, but for many years there was a school of history, a school of historians that condemned Reconstruction, and they pushed blatantly racialist theories for doing so. They basically said it was a mistake to give the benefits of citizenship to a race that they thought was ill-equipped to exercise them. And that's the school of history that dominated, frankly, well after the Civil Rights Movement. People were commonly taught in high school history, that high school U.S. history, that Reconstruction was this really horrible or at least a misguided experiment. And during that period, historians who always idolized Lincoln pretty much from the moment of his assassination presumed, that they concluded in answer, in response to this what-if question, that, well, if Lincoln had survived, he would surely have pushed a more forgiving and moderate Reconstruction policy, which is a euphemistic way of saying he wouldn't have pushed so hard on civil rights. And then after the Civil Rights Movement occurred and after historians reassessed Reconstruction, it's funny to see how they modified their stance on Lincoln. And now they've picked and chosen words from his last speeches in which he seemed open to at least limited suffrage for former slaves at some point. They said, essentially, oh, wait, did we say before that he wouldn't have pushed for civil rights? Oh, no, we mean that he actually would have pushed stringently for civil rights. And they sort of aligned their, at any given moment, they aligned their view of Lincoln with the emotions that seemed to attach to his reputation. In Grant's case, under at least this, the school, or at least the group of historians that had the view that the caller identified, you had for many years when Reconstruction is being pilloried by historians, everyone, there's not a single dissenter among the historians, say that Grant pushed for this too stringently. They called him a tyrant. They said he was so aggressive in his pursuit of civil rights. Why didn't he just listen to the country and abandon them? And then the moment Reconstruction becomes a good thing, they say, oh, wait a second, we were saying Grant was stringently pushing for Reconstruction. Well, now, perhaps in the zeal for embracing Reconstruction and embracing civil rights, they're now, changing the underlying facts and aligning their own recounting of what happened with the seemingly negative emotions that have attached
to
Grant. It's kind of funny to see.
What about this reputation of his being a hard drinker? What about the extent of his problems with alcohol? I guess the other idea that we have is that he drank so much, you'd have to believe that it would interfere with his effectiveness.
That is the notion that Grant was a drunkard or an alcoholic is probably the most enduring myth about him, which is not to say that there was never an issue with alcohol. We have reason to believe, although the evidence is anecdotal and sketchy, that for a period of perhaps a year and a half or 2 years when he was stationed on the Pacific coast between 1852 and 1854, when he was separated from his family, he was with a hard-drinking outfit in the peacetime army, and separated from his family and enduring illness and a lot of bad luck in trying to raise money along with his fellow soldiers, there's reason to believe that he engaged in heavy drinking at that point. And there were rumors that followed him even at the time when he was in the Civil War, that really dated back to those peacetime army days. But to the extent that there's a controversy about alcohol, it's largely confined to the war period. And frankly, with hundreds of thousands of Grant manuscripts, and you could read the papers of Ulysses S. Grant, which have been so capably edited by John Simon and under the auspices of the Ulysses S. Grant Association, you could see that there's actually no evidence that he was a heavy drinker or that he indulged during the war, certainly not when it counted and certainly not on any systematic basis. There was never a time during the war when he was absent from the scene where there was any reason to believe he would have been incapacitated by heavy drinking or otherwise. And that's not to say that he never drank too much during the war, but I think the myth arose from people who were jealous of his success. Remember, he starts the war out as a very subordinate general, and he makes his way up the old-fashioned way. I mean, he earns it, but not without evoking the ire of less capable generals who are above him. And, you know, it's an aspect of the myth of the lost cause, just the bashing of those who are responsible and those who led the country during the Civil War and Reconstruction, that the myth was, in a sense, resurrected and attached to him in the history books. But I will say, with respect to his presidency, that even his worst, his most bitter critics never suggested that alcohol abuse was an issue during his presidency. It is interesting to see that during his 8 years in the White House, when he actually is in the public eye for that protracted period of time, there's not a single account of him ever drinking too much. And those who are experts on the subject of alcoholism, which I am not, have pointed out that the mark of a true alcoholic is one who will either drink nothing at all, or when they do drink, they can't control themselves, they'll drink too much. Well, we see President Grant at dinners, informal and formal, having wine with meals. There's no issue there at all. And so when you're looking at his presidency, no one's ever suggested that alcohol was an issue.
Interesting. Thanks, Jerry, for your call. Diana is next from Blair. Hi, Diana.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I just was wondering what your guest thinks about Grant's policy towards the Native Americans in the West during his tenure as president, and I'll listen off air.
All right. Thanks, Diana.
Well, thank you. That's another good question. Grant assumed office on the eve of what could have been the complete policy of genocide and really a wiping out of Native Americans, of the original occupants of this land, as Grant called them. There was a nominal reservation policy that was in place when Grant took office, but in fact, the government was engaged in protracted war with the various tribes. The tribes were treated like foreign entities with whom you could make treaties and, of course, break the treaties. Grant pushed through what was known as the Quaker Indian Peace Policy. It was a policy under which the Native Americans were, for the first time in history, to be treated as wards of the state, as people whose individual welfare was the responsibility of the government. They would no longer be treated as sovereign nations, whose people's condition was of no concern to the government, and you would in fact, you know, approach Indians from this very different standpoint. There were new administrators who had designated a whole new agency that was designated to provide educational and medical programs within the Department of the Interior, and over the course of Grant's presidency, you had, you know, tons of food, clothing, and books that were donated by churches and relief organizations to tribes. And in fact, during his presidency, the number of houses on Indian reservations climbed by a factor of eight. I think it increased eightfold. And the amount of land that was under cultivation increased sixfold.
Oh, my.
The number of teachers in schools tripled. Indian ownership of livestock increased by over 15 times. Now, at the same time, the policy came far from conferring on the Native Americans a promised land, you still had Indian wars that continued. You, as long as you had settlers out, you know, extending across the continent, you were going to have these run-ins with the military. There was a tragic episode during and in the aftermath of the Black Hills controversy, in which the Indians were basically strong-armed into giving up land after gold was purportedly discovered in the territory. And the Battle of Little Bighorn, Custer's last stand, occurred in 1876. Grant was still in office. He thought it was he did not have a very high opinion of Custer, and he thought what happened was completely unnecessary. In reference to the utter defeat of Custer and his command, but despite those setbacks and the continued Indian wars, you did have a record on Native American policy that that stands above that of most other administrations, mm-hmm. and in fact it. It set the Native American on a path that would eventually lead in years later to their ultimate citizenship.
Eugene from Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. I run a shoeshine stand during the summer Civil War reenactments, and I've never ceased to be amazed at the knowledge, how knowledgeable those reenactors are. I've done Grant a couple times and had him on the stand. And people would start asking him questions. And once or twice after he got done shining his shoes, he got down and he said, you know, he said, I got 30 books on General Grant on my library shelf at home. He said, they don't fool me. Both those guys that do those are generally pretty good. That's my only comment.
Thanks, Eugene.
Yeah.
Let's go to Rich next from Sullivan. Hey, Rich.
Hi. Kathleen. Good morning. On a recent program on America's Finest Presidents, I made a claim that friends and family thought was a bit outlandish. I said Lyndon Baines Johnson was a great president, and it was ironic for me because I was a resistor during the Vietnam War, and I'm not talking about international relations. I was talking about domestic policies, and I'm wondering if your guest sees any parallels between the activities or actions or the trying to work with Congress of Lyndon Baines Johnson, because in that program I said he brought to fruition much of what Lincoln had set in motion a century before.
Professor Switzer.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for the question. I do think there is a strong parallel to be made between Grant and LBJ, particularly on the issue of civil rights. And it is interesting when we talk about the legacy of Lincoln that was revived in the late 20th century. I don't dispute, of course, that it was part of the legacy of Lincoln, although I would say it's even more precisely the legacy of Grant, because Grant was someone who was not only he not only had a hand in emancipation as its principal enforcer during the Civil War, but as president, he actually pursued these measures and secured these measures that I described that ensured civil rights, that ensured civil equality and voting rights. And it was Lyndon Johnson, more than any president of the 20th century, who really brought back that legacy. Now, you have to credit Harry Truman with desegregating the military as well as much of the federal government, and with Eisenhower for pushing through the first civil rights legislation after Grant, after Reconstruction. But it was LBJ, particularly in his very skillful leadership in securing the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and there was also significant, even if not quite on the same level as the Fair Housing Act in 68, it was Johnson and his ability as president in dealing with Congress that enabled him to secure these measures. And it's those measures in the aftermath of Brown v. Board of Education and the desegregation decisions that really brought back, some call the civil rights movement the second Reconstruction, but it's precisely because of those measures that Johnson had pursued. And Johnson, of course, had a very checkered presidency. This is one reason I'm not much of a believer in presidential polls where you give every single president a rating of great or poor, because there are some, like Johnson, in which you have such stunning achievement in one realm and stunning failure in another. But on the subject of civil rights, I think there is a great parallel, and that's the president who, more than any other, was responsible for reviving the legacy of Lincoln and of Grant.
Interesting. Thanks, Rich, for your always great questions and comments. This is other common perceptions that we have of Grant. This is just something from an old book I have, which I love, on the American president. And it has to do with problems in the government, with corruption in the government. Grant saying, I was the subject of abuse and slander scarcely ever equaled in political history. Charges were openly made of corruption on the part of the president or those employed by him. Mistakes have been made, and I admit, he wrote in his annual message to Congress, failures have been errors of judgment, not of intent. The authors of this book say that it was soon clear that Grant possessed little of the firmness he had shown in the Army. Though he was personally honest, his administration was scandal-ridden. He was as deaf to misdoings as he was to music. He could barely recognize Hail to the Chief. He was never able to put an end to the graft and corruption that undermined his presidency, and by the end of 8 years, every single one of his executive offices had come under congressional investigation. When you say Grant, a lot of people would say, what do you think of? They would say corruption.
Yeah, that's the most that's the predominant criticism that you hear of his administration, and that was perhaps the first thing that caused me to scratch my head on assessments of his presidency. The fact of the matter is, what you've just recited, although it includes a couple of quotes from Grant, it's a part, unfortunately, of history by literary impression rather than by any sort of substantive and careful analysis. The vast majority of what has been called corruption during Grant's years in the White House is merely the practice of the spoils system or the patronage system, the system in which you basically gave positions to people in government in the civil service based upon their political loyalties. You had a system in place that was actually invented, some would say, by Thomas Jefferson, and others would say by Andrew Jackson. And there's a real problem of consistency on the part of historians if they're in fact going to embrace that innuendo that was engaged in by the civil service reformers of the 1870s, because if in fact the patronage system was synonymous with corruption, then you have to explain how presidents from Jackson on, including Lincoln, who boasted that he had distributed more patronage than any of his predecessors, how they would somehow come off scot-free. People who wanted to change from the patronage system to a civil service system in which there would be a merit-based system and tests that would be objective tests that would be administered for civil service positions, unfortunately created a body of criticisms in the press of the day and have left impressions that historians have basically adopted in raising the corruption charge. That's not to say that there weren't specific instances of corruption, but when you ask, Nixon had his Watergate. Well, what was Grant's Watergate? What was his big scandal? Well, the biggest scandal of the time, when you look to the issue of real corruption, was the Credit Mobilier. But that was a congressional scandal in which several members of Congress were essentially bribed by the company that was financing the Union Pacific Railroad with the expectation that they wouldn't engage in investigation. And it's something that occurred, it's kind of irrelevant to the presidency because it's a legislative scandal to begin with, but it also occurred before Grant became president, and it was only uncovered during his years in office. When Grant made that statement that he's been the subject of abuse and slander scarcely equaled in our history, that was delivered during his second inaugural address at a time when there had not been a single uncovering of, and there's still to this day, is not a single piece of evidence that anyone in his administration up to that time demonstrated any sort of corrupt activity. Now, the last statement about mistakes that were made or of judgment and not of intent, that occurred at a time when you actually did have the big scandal, maybe a not-so-big scandal, but it was the closest thing you'd have to Grant's household, where his Secretary of War, William Belknap, basically accepted payoffs from someone who was taking money, a guy who held an Indian post tradership, which were pretty lucrative at the time. He was basically paying someone off so that he would be able to keep that post. Well, as soon as Grant found out about it, he asked for his resignation, and he accepted his resignation, and he tried to have him prosecuted, but there wasn't actually evidence to do so. Grant seemed to believe in later years that his Secretary of War took the money unwittingly, because it was his wife who had at that point been deceased who actually arranged for the bribe. But I think Belknap is the only member of his cabinet, at least, who gives you a demonstrable case of corruption. It is not true that every department in his administration was being investigated by Congress at the end, but that last Congress during his presidency did embark on what I think even a lot of traditional historians would agree were partisan witch hunts, because they were just out to get him. They engaged in scurrilous investigations that were far more based on partisanship than anything else. And you know, there were a couple of other instances of people who are trying to take advantage of the government. You have stuff that was occurring a bit farther down the food chain, but making the case that Grant was distinctively, that he somehow belongs in a unique pantheon of poor presidents because of a record of corruption, I don't think it withstands scrutiny when you consider the long record that we have had of scandals in presidencies, and Washington and Lincoln were not exempt from them.
Frank Scaturro is our guest. We're re-examining Ulysses S. Grant this hour of the program, and Frank is our guest. He's the author of President Grant Reconsidered, and as you heard him say, he's been interested in the American presidency since the age of 7. He founded the Grant Monument Association, drawing attention, you'll recall this story, to the disrepair of Grant's tomb in New York City. And we're looking at a lot of scholars starting to reconsider this presidency and talk about how effective Ulysses S. Grant was. What do you think? We're taking phone calls. We have a line open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kurt is our next caller from Germantown. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Kurt.
Kathleen, I'd like to know, possibly Frank can give us some information about after his presidency. I understand that Mr. and Mrs. Grant took a one-year tour around the world where they were hailed as heroes in every country they went to night after night. Music, fireworks, the grandest entertainment of the time.
I've heard that, too.
And I also heard a story where he and his wife left a dinner that was thrown for them in India after 86 courses. And
86?
And it went for 114 courses.
I've never heard that story, Frank.
Yes, there. I don't remember the number of courses on that particular occasion, but after his presidency, he embarked on a two-year trip around the world where he was greeted as royalty would be greeted. It was a remarkable thing because, although there were two previous presidents, Van Buren and Fillmore, who had traveled abroad after their presidency, this was seen, but Grant modestly saw this as nothing more than a reflection of the increasing prominence of America in the world. I mean, they had just fought the civil war between the largest army in the world and the second largest army in the world, and the country was on the verge of being a world power, even if it didn't quite have that status yet. Grant was also the most famous military leader living at the time, and so he was already a legend. He was already an international superstar. And there was a cartoon published, I don't know if it was by Puck, it was by one of the newspapers of the time, that summarized his world tour with various depictions of Grant in different settings, always at the dinner table with a bib around his neck with a fork and knife, just getting different cuisines with people from different countries surrounding him in each shot, and you had like several different shots of him just eating in different locations. But the world tour was a success even beyond the pleasure of seeing the world, because Grant got to not only meet world leaders, and he was reportedly the first person ever to shake the hand of the Japanese emperor, but he was also able to weigh in on and mediate disputes from time to time, including one between China and Japan when he met with the Chinese viceroy, Li Hung Chang. There's a great account of this in a book called Ulysses S. Grant, Essays and Documents. It's a compilation edited by John Simon, but there's a chapter in this book called Diplomat Extraordinaire that summarizes how effective Grant actually was on this world tour. And if those of you think that Grant was not much of a political leader, or that he wasn't much of a politician, or that he didn't learn much during his 8 years in the White House, should take a look at this. Take a look at how he operated on the world stage, and I think you'll be surprised by what you see.
Yeah, it would be new information to a lot of people. I don't think we think of Grant as operating on the world stage. We think of him as helping to save the Union. You think also that this was a really big guy, you know, a warrior, 5'7", 150 pounds, and he was eating like that all around the world?
Yeah, he was at full height, he was 5'8". During the Civil War, he was as slim as 135 pounds.
Oh, my.
And I think he was above 150. It probably hit 175. It may have even been approaching the 200 mark. I think the world tour, that period,
put a few pounds
the greatest
on
girth. Yes, yes.
Priscilla is next. Hi, Priscilla from Milwaukee.
I want to thank you very, very much for this program. I have been a fan of, I guess you'd call it a fan of General Grant for years, and I have read I don't know how many books on the subject of General Grant, but I'd always kind of worry about when it got to the presidency. But I had begun to read things that happened during the presidency, and I think, wait a minute, this sounds like a good thing that he did. This isn't the picture that I have him as president. So I'm very eager to read your book, but I have two special comments for Kathleen. I know you're from Illinois, and I know you're a big Lincoln fan. I am from Illinois, and I'm a big Lincoln fan, and I think Grant is, if from Illinois, you have to read more about Grant, and you have to know about him, because they're almost like twin people being so important in the Civil War. And the other thing is for the guest. If you go to the National Portrait Gallery, and you see the picture, the portrait there of President Grant, on the caption there, it's very denigrating to his presidency, and I think you ought to go there and make them change it. I saw it. We were there in November, and I kept telling my husband, that's not right. They shouldn't have that. That's not right. So you
have
a job there to go and make them change that. But, again, thank you very, very much for this program. I'm looking forward. I'm going to buy your book as soon as I can.
Thank you, Priscilla,
Thanks
for
so
the
much.
Call. Well, I guess she sent you on another mission. I know you were on a mission to take care of his tomb in New York City. There's another one for you.
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say I've been to the National Portrait Gallery and seen that portrait several times, and I probably just haven't seen the – I just didn't bother looking at the inscription that the caller was referring to, but we've got to take a look at that and – that, not only that, but also the White House website.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to make you do something that you don't want to do, so say no if that's okay. He has been, though. We look at the most effective presidents. We tend to look at things in lists like that. He is, among scholars, moving up in the rankings, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. He is. And despite the comments I made earlier about some of the recent scholars casting doubts on his civil rights record. In fact, just about every study of his presidency that's at least devoted to his presidency over the last dozen years or so has been really positive on the presidency. It's the encyclopedic works, the works that talk about his presidency superficially, that will still often recycle the earlier impressions, and that's largely because even in the historical profession, there are a lot of people who are just not who are not experts and who've not really delved into the facts that deeply or who have not been familiar mm-hmm. with more recent scholarship.
Thank you so much for being with us. I really enjoyed the hour and learned a lot.
Thanks, same here. Frank, thanks for having me.
Frank Scaturo, he is the author of President Grant Reconsidered, and we thank Christy Pease for producing this program. He's a visiting professor at Hofstra University School of Law. John Treader, our on-air producer. Thank you, John. Seems an appropriate time to tell you that I'm going to be narrating Copeland's Lincoln's Portrait, and this is going to be a week from Sunday, the 28th of March. Those of you who are in Milwaukee, it should be just a great afternoon. The Festival City Symphony is going to be performing that and Samuel Barber, so I hope you can be there. Go to my Facebook page. I'm going to put more information up on that today. Thanks for listening.